to realize it was there.
Yeah, lovely, thanks. Claire replied distractedly, as predicted, the jokey threat of imminent poisoning failing to register. Gina sat in her usual chair, directly across from her distracted friend, in the distracted friend's kitchen. It was only a few miles away from her home in Glasgow's city centre, so she dropped by at least a couple of times a week for dinner, and these Sunday cuppas were weekly events. They'd been best mates for over 25 years and stuck together through thick, thin, and opposing views on their favourite member of Take That, Gina, Robbie, Claire, Howard. Today, however, was more of an emergency visitation situation. Gina was here to provide emotional support and consolation in her friend's time of need. Unfortunately, as always, that came out like brutal honesty and flippant disregard for the gravity of the situation. "Stop staring at the phone. He isn't going to call. Caramel wafer?" Claire still didn't look up. "No, I haven't been to Zumba for a fortnight. My arse is the size of a beanbag." Claire paused, her eyes finally leaving the phone to dart to the biscuit tin that was now silently shouting to her from the middle of the table. She tugged on the sleeve of her standard comfy jumper, then assessed the tightness of the waistband on her equally standard jeans. It wasn't cutting off the blood supply to her extremities, so there was room for indulgence. "Sod it, I'll have one. Big arses are in fashion these days." As always, Gina resisted temptation. A dedicated gym-goer with buttocks like melons, she hadn't willingly consumed a non-alcoholic carb since the 90s. Her daily dress code of trainers, lycra running tights, a tiny vest and a clingy hoodie was a constant reminder that her body was a temple that could not be violated by Claire's stash of high-calorie snacks. She took a sip of her green tea and spotted that Claire's eyes had strayed back to her phone.
"Dear God, will you give it up? He isn't going to call."
Claire swallowed the heady combination of caramel, chocolate and wafer before replying with as much indignation as she could muster.
"He is." "No, he isn't. You're wasting your life waiting around for him and he isn't going to call. You realise this is an exact replica of a conversation we had when we were 15 and you were madly in love with the bloke who played the bass guitar in that crap band that assaulted our ears down the youth club disco."
Claire tried to be offended, but the 24-year-old memory made her react with something between a laugh and a cringe.
"Bobby Wright! I wrote my telephone number on the towel he used to wipe the sweat off his brow between sets. I was sure he was the next John Bon Jovi. He works in the butchers in the high street now, and I can't buy pork chops with a straight face."
Gina giggled.
"Go vegetarian. It'll save the embarrassment. But the point is, back then, Bobby Bon Jovi didn't call, and Geordie isn't going to call either."
Claire knew she was right, but she couldn't bring herself to give up hope. Back in 1994, her 18-year-old heart could take the rejection. But this was different. It wasn't some teenage crush she was waiting to hear from. All she wanted to see on the screen was an incoming call from her youngest child, Jordan Samuel Bradley, age 18, her son. The one who'd gone off to university last week without an ounce of hesitation. It wasn't even as if it was somewhere in Scotland and he'd be popping home every weekend with his washing. Nope. A soccer scholarship had taken him to a university in Tennessee, just outside Nashville. Getting there had been a long, arduous process, sacrificing normal teenage life to train, work, graft, make himself the best player he could be. She was beyond proud and thrilled that it had paid off and he'd achieved the goal he'd set himself when he first went to high school. Yet every time she thought of him being away for 4 years, she had an urge to break into full Whitney Houston mode and deliver a tearful yet dramatic rendition of "I Will Always Love You." His independence was nothing new.